securities fraud, insider trading. We're checking out witnesses. We know he spent some time in D.C. We know he visited you on Mystique last Christmas. We know that in January he short-sold a chunk of Goffman for 62¼ a share the day before you filed your big lawsuit. Bought it back at 49, made himself several million. We think he had access to a confidential government report on a certain Goffman drug called Maxitil, and he used that information to commit securities fraud. Anything else? Lush stopped writing and said, Did you short-sell Goffman before you filed suit? I did not. Have you ever owned Goffman stock? No. Lush put his pen in his pocket. Good cops keep their first meetings brief. Let the witness slash target slash subject sweat and maybe do something foolish. The second one would be much longer. They stood and headed for the door. If you hear from Pace, we'd like to know about it, Spooner said. Don't count on it, Clay said. He could never betray Pace because they shared so many secrets. Oh, we're counting on it, Mr. Carter. Next visit, we'll talk about Ackerman Labs. After 2 years and $8 billion in cash settlements, Healthy Living, the company that made the Skinny Ben diet pill, filed for bankruptcy protection under Chapter 11 and walked away from the mess. The news was a surprise to the financial community, but no group was more shocked than the Mass Tort Bar. They had finally strangled the golden goose. Oscar Mulrooney saw it online at his desk and locked his door. Under his leadership, the firm had spent $2.2 million in advertising and medical testing, which had so far yielded 215 legitimate Skinny Ben clients. At an average settlement of $180,000, the cases were worth at least $15 million in attorney's fees, which would be the basis of Oscar's much-anticipated year-end bonus. Sweating, he worked the phone for an hour, calling other lawyers in the class, trying to get through to the administrator, then the judge. His worst fears were confirmed by a lawyer in Nashville, one with several hundred cases, all filed ahead of Oscar's. "We're screwed," the lawyer said. "Healthy Living has liabilities four times that of its assets, and there is no cash. We're screwed." An hour later, Oscar prepared a letter to each of his 215 clients. He gave them no false hope. Things indeed looked bleak. The firm would closely monitor the bankruptcy in the company. It would aggressively pursue all possible means of compensation, but there was little reason to be optimistic. The meeting occurred late at night, just as Clay was leaving his office. It began with unpleasant business and did not improve. Criddle walked in with a sour face and announced, "Our liability insurance carrier is notifying us that they are canceling coverage." "What?" Clay yelled. "You heard me. Why are you telling me now? I'm late for dinner. I've been talking to them all day." A brief time out while Clay flung his jacket on the sofa and walked to the window. "Why?" he asked. "They've evaluated your practice and they don't like what they see. 24,000 Maxitil cases scare them. There's too much exposure if something goes wrong. Their 10 million could be a drop in the bucket, so they're jumping ship."
"Can they do it?"
"Of course they can. An insurance company can terminate coverage anytime it wants. They'll owe us a refund, but it's peanuts. We're naked on this, Clay. No coverage."
"We won't need coverage."
"I hear you, but I'm still worried." "You were worried about Dyloff, too, as I recall, and I was wrong."
"Well, Rex, old boy, you're wrong about Maxitil, too. After Mr. Mooneyham gets finished with Goffman and Flagstaff, they'll be anxious to settle. The trial out there is set for September. When it's over, the money will pour in again."
"We've spent $8 million on advertising and testing," Criddle said. "Can we at least slow down? Why can't you take the position that 24,000 cases is enough?"
"Because it's not enough." And with that, Clay smiled, picked up his jacket, patted Criddle on the shoulder, and left for dinner. He was supposed to meet a former college roommate at the old Ebbett Grill on 15th at 8:30. He waited at the bar for almost an hour before his cell phone rang. The roommate was stuck in a meeting that looked as if it would never end. He gave the usual apologies. As Clay was leaving, he glanced into the restaurant and saw Rebecca having dinner with two other ladies. He stepped back, found his bar stool, and ordered another ale. He was very aware that she had once again stopped him in his tracks. He wanted desperately to talk to her, but he was determined not to interfere. A trip to the restroom would work fine. As he walked by her table, She looked up and immediately smiled. Rebecca introduced Clay to her two friends, and he explained that he was in the bar waiting for an old college buddy for dinner. The guy was running late. It might be a while. Sorry for the interruption. Oh, well, gotta run. Nice seeing you. 15 minutes later, Rebecca appeared in the crowded bar and stood close beside him. Very close.
I just have a minute, she said. They're waiting.
She nodded at the restaurant.
You look great, Clay said, anxious to start groping.
You too.
Where's Myers?
She shrugged as if she didn't care. Working. He's always working.
How's married life?
Very lonely, she said, looking away.
Clay took a drink. If not in a crowded bar with friends waiting nearby, she would have spilled her guts. There was so much she wanted to say. The marriage is not working. Clay fought to suppress a smile.
I'm still waiting, he said.
Her eyes were wet when she leaned over and kissed him on the cheek. Then she was gone without another word. Mr. Ted Worley awoke from a rare nap and decided to go to the toilet. After the Dyloft nightmare, he didn't push the limits of his bladder. Not too many liquids, no beer at all, and no pressure on the plumbing down there. If he needed to go, then he did not hesitate. He walked to the small guest bathroom down the hall, next to the bedroom where Mrs. Worley was perched in her rocker doing the needlepoint that consumed most of her life. He closed the door behind him, unzipped his pants, and began to urinate. A very slight burning sensation caused him to glance down, and when he did, he almost fainted. His urine was the color of rust, a dark reddish liquid. He gasped and braced himself with one hand against the wall. It was blood, he decided. The tumors were back, and whatever form they now had, they were far more serious than before. He told his wife the truth the next morning, over toast and jam. He preferred to keep it from her as long as possible, but they were so joined at the hip that secrets, especially any related to health, were difficult to keep. She took charge immediately, calling his urologist, barking at the appointment secretary, lining up a visit just after lunch. It was an emergency, and tomorrow just wasn't acceptable. 4 days later, malignant tumors were found in Mr. Worley's kidneys. During 5 hours of surgery, the doctors removed all the tumors they could find. The head of urology was closely monitoring the patient. A colleague at a hospital in Kansas City had reported an identical case a month earlier, a post-Dyloft appearance of kidney tumors. The patient in Kansas City was now undergoing chemotherapy and fading fast. The same could be expected for Mr. Worley, though the oncologist was much more cautious in his first post-op visit. The patient, he said, would be discharged in a week or so, and as soon as he was strong enough, they would begin aggressively treating his cancer. Mr. Worley was crying when the meeting was over. During a follow-up conversation with the colleague in Kansas City, the head of urology learned of yet another case. All three patients had been Group 1 Dyloft plaintiffs. Now they were dying. A lawyer's name was mentioned. The Kansas City patient was represented by a small firm in New York City. It was a rare and rewarding experience for a doctor to be able to pass along the name of one lawyer who would sue another, and the head of urology was determined to enjoy the moment. He entered Mr. Worley's room, introduced himself because they had not met, and explained his role in the treatment. The conversation soon made its way to Dyloft, then the settlement, then to the fertile grounds of the legal profession. This fired up the old man. His face had some color. His eyes were glaring. The settlement, meager as it was, had been completed against his wishes. A paltry $43,000, with the lawyer taking the rest.
I was against the settlement, Mr. Worley kept saying.
I guess it's too late now, Mrs. Worley kept adding.
Maybe not, the doctor said. He told them about the Kansas City patient, a man very similar to Ted Worley. He's hired a lawyer to go after his lawyer, the doctor said with great satisfaction.
I've had a butt full of lawyers, Mr. Worley said. Doctors, too, for that matter, but he held his tongue.
Do you have his phone number? Mrs. Worley asked.
She was thinking much more clearly than her husband. Sadly, she was also looking down the road a year or two when Ted would be gone. The urologist just happened to have the number.
The only thing mass tort lawyers feared was one of their own. A predator. A traitor who followed behind fixing their mistakes. A subspecialty had evolved in which a few very good and very nasty trial lawyers pursued their brethren for bad settlements. Helen Warshaw was writing the training manual. Warshaw had 4 Dyloft cases in her New York office and leads on 3 more when she received the call from Mrs. Worley. Her small firm had a file on Clay Carter and a much thicker one on Patton French. She monitored the top 20 or so mass tort firms in the country and dozens of the biggest class actions. She had plenty of clients and lots of fees, but nothing had excited her as much as the Dyloft fiasco. A few minutes on the phone with Mrs. Worley, and Helen knew exactly what had happened. "I'll be there by 5 o'clock," she said.
"Today?"
"Yes, this afternoon." She caught the shuttle to Dulles. She did not have her own jet for 2 very good reasons. First, she was prudent with her money and didn't believe in such waste. Second, if she ever got sued, she did not want the jury to hear about a jet. She rented a car, no limo, and found the hospital in Bethesda. Mrs. Worley had collected their papers, which Warshaw spent an hour with while Mr. Worley took a nap. When he woke up, he did not want to talk. He was wary of lawyers, especially the pushy New York female variety. However, his wife had plenty of time and found it easier to confide in a woman. The two went to the lounge for coffee and a long discussion. The principal culprit was and always would be Ackerman Labs. They made a bad drug, rushed the approval process, advertised it heavily, failed to adequately test it, failed to fully disclose everything they knew about it. The second culprit was the doctor who prescribed the drug, though his culpability was slight. He relied on Ackerman Labs, the drug worked wonders, and so on. Unfortunately, the first 2 culprits had been fully and completely released from all liability when Mr. Worley settled his claim in the Biloxi class action. Though Mr. Worley's arthritis doctor had not been sued, the global release covered him as well.
"But Ted didn't want to settle," Mrs. Worley said more than once.
"Doesn't matter. He settled. He gave his attorney the power to settle. The attorney did so and thus became the 3rd culprit, and the last one standing." A week later, in United States District Court for the District of Columbia, Ms. Warshaw filed a lawsuit against J. Clay Carter, F. Patton French, M. Wesley Salisbury, and all other known and unknown attorneys who had prematurely settled Dyloft cases. The lead plaintiff was once again Mr. Ted Worley from Upper Marlboro, Maryland, for and on behalf of all injured persons known and unknown at the time. Borrowing a page from the defendant's own playbook, Ms. Warshaw faxed copies of her lawsuit to a dozen prominent newspapers 15 minutes after she filed it. A brusque and burly process server presented himself to the receptionist at Clay's office and demanded to see Mr. Carter. "It's urgent," he insisted. He was sent down the hall where he had to deal with Miss Glick. She summoned her boss, who reluctantly came from his office and took possession of the paperwork that would ruin his day. Maybe his year. The reporters were already calling by the time Clay finished reading the class action. Oscar Mulrooney was with him. The door was locked. "I've never heard of this," Clay mumbled, painfully aware that there was so much he didn't know about the mass tort game. Mulrooney was too stunned to speak. Sleep was impossible. Ridley was in St. Barth, renovating the villa, and for that Clay was grateful. He was humiliated and embarrassed. At least she didn't know about it. His thoughts were on Ted Worley. He was not angry, far from it. Allegations and lawsuits are famously off the mark, but these sounded accurate. His former client would not be claiming to have malignant tumors if they did not actually exist. Mr. Worley's cancer was caused by a bad drug, not by a bad lawyer. But to hurriedly settle a case for $62,000 when it was ultimately worth millions smacked of malpractice and greed. Who could blame the man for striking back? Shortly after 4 a.m., Clay made the first pot of coffee. At 5, he went online and read the Post. A slow news day, so why not put the smiling face of the King of Torts on the front page, bottom half? "Mass Tort Lawyer Sued by the Masses," was the clever headline. The first paragraph read, "Washington attorney J. Clay Carter, the so-called newest King of Torts, received a taste of his own medicine yesterday when he was sued by some disgruntled clients. The lawsuit alleges that Carter, who earned a reported $110 million in fees last year, prematurely settled cases for small amounts when they were, in fact, worth millions." An unnamed source put the number of plaintiffs at a dozen. Class certification was expected because a much larger group of plaintiffs was anticipated.
How large? Clay asked himself as he made more coffee. How many Worleys are out there?
He was at the office by 7, with a game face on, high on coffee, bouncing around the halls bantering and laughing with the early shift, making lame but sporting jokes about other process servers on the way and reporters poking around and subpoenas flying here and there. It was a gutsy, splendid performance, one his firm needed and appreciated. It continued until mid-morning, when Miss Glick stopped it cold by stepping into his open office and saying, "Clay, those 2 FBI agents are back."
"Wonderful," he said, rubbing his hands together as if he might just whip both of them.
Spooner and Lush appeared with tight smiles and no handshakes. Clay closed the door, gritted his teeth, and told himself to keep performing. But the fatigue hit hard, and the fear. Lush would talk this time while Spooner took notes. Evidently, Clay's picture on the front page had reminded them that he was owed a second visit. The price of fame.
"Any sign of your buddy Pace?" Lush began.
"No, not a peep." And it was true. How badly he needed Pace's counsel in this time of crisis. Lush moved on.
"You filed suit against Ackerman Labs on July 2nd of last year, correct?"
"Yes."
"Did you own any stock in the company before you filed the lawsuit?"
"No."
"Did you sell the stock short, then buy it back at a lower price?"
Of course he had, at the suggestion of his good friend Pace. They knew the answer to the question. They had the data from the transactions, he was sure of that. Since their first visit, he had thoroughly researched securities fraud and insider trading. He was in a gray area, a very pale one, in his opinion, not a good place to be, but far from guilty. In retrospect, he should not have dealt in the stock. He wished 1,000 times he had not.
"Am I under investigation for something?" he asked.
Spooner started nodding before Lush said, "Yes."
"Then this meeting is over. My attorney will be in touch with you."
Clay was on his feet, headed for the door.
The next meeting of the Dyloft Plaintiff Steering Committee, Defendant Patton French chose a hotel in downtown Atlanta where he was participating in one of his many seminars on how to get rich stalking drug companies. It was an emergency meeting. French, of course, had the presidential suite, a gaudy collection of wasted space on the hotel's top floor, and there they met. It was an unusual meeting in that there was no comparing notes about the latest luxury car or ranch, none of that. Things were tense from the moment Clay entered the suite, and they never improved. The rich boys were scared. And with good reason. Carlos Hernandez from Miami knew of 7 of his Dyloft Group 1 plaintiffs who were now suffering from malignant kidney tumors. They had joined the class action and were now represented by Helen Warshaw.
"They're popping up everywhere," he said frantically.
He looked as if he hadn't slept in days. In fact, all 5 looked beaten and weary.
"She's a ruthless bitch," Wes Salisbury said, and the others nodded in agreement.
Evidently, the legend of Ms. Warshaw was widely known. Someone had forgotten to tell Clay. Wes had 4 former clients now suing him. Damon Didier had 3. French had 5. Clay was mightily relieved to have only 1, but such relief was temporary.
"Actually, you have 7, French said, and handed over a printout with Clay's name at the top and a list of ex-clients-slash-now-plaintiffs under it. "I'm told by Wicks at Ackerman that we can expect the list to grow," French said.
"What's their mood?" Wes asked.
"Total shock. Their drug is killing people right and left. Philo wishes they'd never heard of Ackerman Labs."
"I'm with them," Didier said, shooting a nasty look at Clay, as if to say, "It's all your fault."
Regardless of how much money they claimed to have, each was worried, but at different levels. Clay did most of the listening, and he became intrigued by how the other 4 were reacting. Patton French probably had more money than anyone there, and he seemed confident he could withstand the financial pressures of the lawsuit. Same for Wes, who had earned $500 million from the tobacco scam. Carlos was cocky at times, but then he couldn't stop fidgeting. It was the hard-faced Didier who was terrified. They all had more money than Clay, and Clay had more Dyloft cases than any of them. He didn't like the math. He picked the number of $3 million as a possibility for settlement. If his list stopped with 7 names, then he can handle a hit in the $20 million range.
But if the list kept growing... Clay brought up the topic of insurance and was shocked to learn that none of the four had any. They had all been terminated years earlier. Very few carriers of legal malpractice would touch a mass tort lawyer. Dyloft was a perfect example of why not. The meeting was nothing more than a bitch and cry session. They wanted the company of each other's misery, but only briefly. They agreed on a very general plan to meet with Ms. Warshaw at some undetermined point in the future and delicately explore the possibility of negotiation. She was making it well known that she did not want to settle. She wanted trials, big, tawdry, sensational spectacles in which the current and past kings of torts would be hauled in and stripped naked before the juries. Clay killed an afternoon and night in Atlanta, where no one knew him. During his years at OPD, Clay had conducted hundreds of initial interviews, almost all at the jail. They usually started slow, with the defendant, who was almost always black, uncertain about how much he should say to his white lawyer. The background information thawed things somewhat, but the facts and details and truth about the alleged crime were rarely given during the first meeting. It was ironic that Clay, the white defendant now, was nervously walking into his own initial interview with his black defense lawyer. And at $750 an hour, Zach Battle had better be prepared to listen fast. No ducking and weaving and shadowboxing at that rate. Battle would get the truth as fast as he could write it down. But Battle wanted to gossip. He and Jarrett had been drinking buddies years earlier, long before Battle sobered up and became the biggest criminal lawyer in D.C. Oh, the stories he could tell about Jarrett Carter. Not at $750 an hour, Clay wanted to say. Turn the damn clock off and we'll chat forever. When they finally got around to it, Clay told the Dyloff story, beginning with Max Pace and ending with the FBI. He did not talk about Tarvan, but he would if it became necessary. Oddly, Battle took no notes. He just listened, frowning and smoking his pipe, gazing off occasionally in deep reflection, but never betraying what he thought. This stolen research that Max Pace had, he said. Then a pause, then a puff. Did you have it in your possession when you sold the stock and filed suit? Of course. I had to know that I could prove liability against Ackerman if we went to trial. Then it's insider trading. You're guilty. 5 years in the slammer. Tell me, though, how the feds can prove it. When his heart began pumping again, Clay said, Max Pace can tell them, I guess. Who else has the research? Patton French, maybe one or two of the other guys? Does Patton French know that you had this information before you filed suit? I don't know. I never told him when I got it. So this Max Pace character is the only person who can nail you. The history was pretty clear. Clay had prepared the Dyloft class action, but was unwilling to file it unless Pace could produce enough evidence. They had argued several times. Pace walked in one day with two thick briefcases filled with papers and files and said, There it is, and you didn't get it from me. He left immediately. Clay reviewed the materials, then asked a college friend to evaluate their reliability. The friend was a prominent doctor in Baltimore. Can this doctor be trusted? Battle asked. Before he could say anything, Battle helped him with the answer. Here's the bottom line, Clay. If the feds don't know you had this secret research when you sold the stock short, they can't get you for insider trading. They have the records of the stock transactions, but those alone are not enough. They have to prove you had knowledge. Should I talk to my friend in Baltimore? No. If the feds know about him, he might be wired. Then you go to prison for 7 years instead of five.
Would you please stop saying that?
And if the feds don't know about him, then you might inadvertently lead them to him. They're probably watching you. They might tap your phones. I'd ditch the research, purge my files just in case they walk in with a subpoena, and I'd also do a lot of praying that Max Pace is either dead or hiding in Europe.
Ridley called, down in St. Barth but wanting to come home. Could Clay please send the jet tomorrow?
No problem, dear. That only costs $3,000 an hour to fly the damn thing. 4 hours down, 4 hours back, $24,000 for the quick round trip, but that was a drop in the bucket compared to what she was spending on the villa.
A couple of days later, an article appeared in the Metro section of the Post. King of Torts under SEC Investigation. Clay read it at home, where he was thankfully alone because Ridley was spending a day or two at her new apartment, one Clay had signed the lease for.
She wanted the freedom of living in two places, hers and his, and since her old flat was quite cramped, Clay had agreed to put her up in nicer digs. Actually, her freedom required a third place, the villa in St. Barth, which she always referred to as ours. Not that Ridley read newspapers anyway. In fact, she seemed to know little of Clay's problems. Her increasing focus was on the spending of his money, with not much attention to how he made it. If she saw the story in the Metro section, she didn't mention it. Nor did he. Paulette Toulos dropped in before noon, and that raised his spirits. She looked great. The pounds were off. The wardrobe was expensive. She'd been bouncing around Europe for the past few months, waiting for her divorce to become final. The rumors about Clay were everywhere, and she was concerned about him. Over a long lunch, one she paid for, it slowly became apparent that she was also worried about herself. Her cut of the Dyloft loot had been slightly over $10 million, and she wanted to know if she had exposure. Clay assured her she had none. She had not been a partner in the firm during the settlement, just an associate. Clay's name was on all the pleadings and documents. "You were the smart one," Clay said. "You took the money and ran."
"I feel bad," Paulette said.
"Don't. The mistakes were made by me, not you."
"And the feds?" she asked.
"They can't touch me."
She seemed to believe this, and her relief was obvious. If, in fact, she did believe everything Clay was saying, she was the only one at the table who did so. The third meeting would be the last, though neither Clay nor anyone on his side of the table realized it. Joel Hanna brought his cousin Marcus, the company's CEO, with him, and left behind Babcock, their insurance counsel. As usual, the two faced a small army on the other side, with Mr. JCC sitting in the middle, the king. During the last meeting, Clay had reduced his demands from $25,000 per claim to $22,500, a settlement that would net him fees in the neighborhood of $7.5 million. The Hanna Company had countered with $17,000, which would stretch its borrowing capacity to the breaking point. "Any movement on your side?" Clay asked, rather bluntly.
"No," Joel said. "$17,000 is a stretch for us. Any movement on your side?"
$22,500 is a fair settlement," Clay said, without flinching or blinking. "If you're not moving, then neither are we." His voice was hard as steel. His staff was impressed by his toughness, but also anxious for some compromise. Marcus Hanna abruptly said,
"Well then, it's time to go."
He and his first cousin threw their papers together and stormed out of the conference room. Clay tried a dramatic exit, too, as if to show his troops that nothing fazed him. 2 hours later, in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, the Hanna Portland Cement Company filed a Chapter 11 petition seeking protection from its creditors, the largest of whom were those collected in a class action filed by J. Clay Carter II of Washington, D.C. Apparently, one of the Hannas understood the importance of leaks. The Baltimore Press ran a long story about the bankruptcy and the immediate reaction by the homeowners. Its details were deadly accurate and evidence that someone very close to the settlement negotiations was whispering to the reporter. The bottom line was that the lawsuit could have been fairly settled but for the issue of attorney's fees. And so began another day at the office. A little bit before noon, there was a commotion outside, sharp, angry voices. Clay ran from his office into the hallway where the security guard was scuffling with a very disturbed gentleman. Associates and secretaries were entering the picture.
"Where is Clay Carter?" the man yelled.
"Here," Clay yelled back and walked up to him. "What do you want?" The man was suddenly still, though the guard kept his grip.
"I'm one of your clients," he said, breathing heavily. "Let go of me."
He shook free from the guard.
"Leave him alone," Clay said. "I'd like a conference with my attorney," the man said.
"This is not the way to schedule one," Clay shot back very coolly. He was being watched by his employees.
"Yeah, well, I tried the other way, but all the lines are busy. You screwed us out of a good settlement with the cement company. We want to know why. Not enough money for you?"
"You folks need to relax and stop reading the papers," Clay said. "We're still working on the settlement." It was a lie, but one with good intentions. The rebellion needed to be quashed, at least there in the office.
"Cut your fees and get us some money," the man snarled, "and that's coming from your clients."
"I'll get you a settlement," Clay said with a fake smile. "Just relax." The man backed away, then turned and left the suite.
Back to work, everybody, Clay said, clapping his hands together as if everybody had plenty of work to do. Rebecca arrived an hour later, a random visitor from the street. She stepped into the JCC suite and gave a note to the receptionist.
Please give that to Mr. Carter, she said. It's very important.
The receptionist glanced at the security guard, who was on high alert, and it took several seconds to determine that the attractive young lady was probably not a threat.
I'm an old friend, Rebecca said.
Whatever she was, she managed to fetch Mr. Carter out of the back faster than anyone in the short history of the firm. They sat in the corner of his office, Rebecca on the sofa, Clay in a chair pulled as close as possible. For a long time, nothing was said. Clay was too excited to utter a coherent sentence. Her presence could mean 100 different things, none of them bad.
You're staring at my legs, she finally said.
Yes, I am.
Clay, are you okay? There's so much bad press right now.
And that's why you're here?
Yes, I'm concerned.
To be concerned means you still care about me.
I do.
So you haven't forgotten about me?
No, I have not. I'm sort of sidetracked right now with the marriage and all, but I still think about you.
All the time?
Yes, more and more.
Clay closed his eyes and placed a hand on her knee, one that she immediately removed and flung away.
I am married, Clay.
Then let's commit adultery.
No.
Why not? You're not giving him sex, are you?
We're married.
But he's such a little twerp. I saw you dancing at your reception, and I wanted to vomit. Tell me he's lousy in bed.
He's lousy in bed. What about the bimbo?
She likes girls. They both laughed, and for a long time. And then they were silent again, because there was so much to say. She crossed her legs while Clay watched closely. He could almost touch them. Are you going to survive? She asked. Let's not talk about me. Let's talk about us.
I'm not going to have an affair, she said.
But it would be fun, wouldn't it?
It would, and it wouldn't. I'm not going to live like that.
I'm not either, Rebecca. I'm not sharing. I once had all of you, and I let you get away. I'll wait until you're single again, but would you hurry, damn it?
That might not happen, Clay.
Yes, it will.
With Ridley in bed beside him, Clay spent the night dreaming of Rebecca. He slept off and on, always waking up with a goofy smile on his face. All smiles vanished, though, when the phone rang just after 5 a.m. He answered it in the bedroom, then switched to a phone in his study. It was Mel Snelling, a college roommate, now a physician in Baltimore.
"We gotta talk, pal," he said. "It's urgent."
"All right," Clay said, his knees buckling. 10 a.m. in front of the Lincoln Memorial.
I can do that.
And there's a good chance someone will be following me, he said. Then his line went dead. Dr. Snelling had reviewed the stolen Dyloft research for Clay as a favor. Now the feds had found him. For the first time, Clay had the wild thought of just simply running. Wire what was left of the money to some banana republic, skip town, grow a beard, disappear. And, of course, take Rebecca with him. Her mother would find them before the feds. He made coffee and took a long shower. He dressed in jeans and would have said goodbye to Ridley, but she hadn't moved. There was a very good chance Mel would be wired. Zach Battle was out of town, so Clay was on his own. He arrived at the Lincoln Memorial at 9:20 and mixed with the few tourists who were there. A few minutes later, Mel appeared, which immediately struck Clay as odd. Why would he get there half an hour before their meeting? Was the ambush being organized? Were Agents Spooner and Lush close by with mics and cameras and guns? They shook hands, said their hellos, tried to be cordial. "Let's go for a walk," Clay said, sort of pointing down the mall toward the Washington Monument.
"Sure," Mel said, shrugging.
He didn't care. Obviously, no trap had been planned near Mr. Lincoln. "Did they follow you?" Clay asked. "I don't think so. I flew from Baltimore to Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh to Reagan National, grabbed a cab. I don't think anybody's behind me."
"Is it Spooner and Lush?"
"Yes, you know them?" "They've stopped by a few times." They were walking beside the reflecting pool, on the sidewalk on the south side. Clay was not going to say anything that he didn't want to hear again. "Mel, I know how the Fibbies operate. Did they ask you to wear a wire?"
"Yes."
And?
I told them hell no.
Thank you. I have a great lawyer, Clay. I spent some time with him, told him everything. I did nothing wrong because I didn't trade the stock. I'm clean. But the pinch comes when I'm subpoenaed by the grand jury.
Go on, Clay said cautiously.
The big question is, how did they find me? I told no one I was reviewing the stuff. Who did you tell?
Absolutely no one, Mel.
That's hard to believe.
I swear, why would I tell anyone?
They stopped for a moment to let the traffic pass on 17th Street. When they were walking again, they drifted to the right, away from a crowd. Mel said, almost under his breath,
If I lie to the grand jury about the research, they'll have a hard time indicting you. But if I get caught lying, then I go to jail myself.
Who else knows I reviewed the research? He asked again.
And with that, Clay realized there were no wires, no mics, no one was listening.
Mel wasn't after evidence. He just wanted to be reassured.
Your name is nowhere, Mel, Clay said. I shipped the stuff to you. We talked by phone a half a dozen times. All of your thoughts and opinions about the research were verbal.
Are you certain? Mel asked.
Anything but certain.
I'm positive.
So what do I do?
Keep listening to your lawyer. There's a good chance this thing won't get to a grand jury, Clay said. More of a prayer than a fact.
If you hold firm, it'll probably go away.
They walked 100 yards without a word. The Washington Monument was getting closer.
If I get a subpoena, Mel said slowly, we'd better talk again.
Of course.
I'm not going to jail over this, Clay.
Neither am I.
The Coconino County Courthouse in Flagstaff was relatively quiet the day before the trial. Business was routine. No hint of the historic and far-reaching conflict soon to be raging there. It was the second week in September, the temperature already pushing 105. Clay and Oscar walked around the downtown area, then quickly entered the courthouse in search of air conditioning. Inside the courtroom, though, pretrial motions were being argued and things were tense. No jury sat in the box. That selection process would begin promptly at 9 the following morning. Dale Mooneyham and his team covered one side of the arena. The Goffman horde, led by a fancy litigator from L.A. named Roger Redding, occupied the other half. Roger the Rocket, because he struck fast and hard. Roger the Dodger, because he went all over the country fighting the biggest trial lawyers he could find, dodging big verdicts. Clay and Oscar took seats with the other spectators, of which there was an impressive number just for motion arguments. Wall Street would watch the trial very closely. Mooneyham lumbered around the courtroom like a barroom bully, bellowing at the judge, then at Roger. His voice was rich and deep, and his words were always contentious. He was an old warrior with a limp that appeared to come and go. Occasionally he picked up a cane to move around with, and at times seemed to forget it. Roger was Hollywood cool, meticulously tailored, a head full of salt and pepper hair, strong chin, perfect profile. Probably wanted to be an actor at some point. He spoke in eloquent prose, beautiful sentences that rolled out with no hesitation. Never an or an ah or a well, no false starts. He had no fear of Dale Mooneyham, no fear of the judge, no fear of the facts of the case. The judge called a 15-minute recess so he could visit the toilet. Clay left the courtroom and went to find a soda. He was about to re-enter the courtroom when a pushy reporter stepped in front of him. He was Derek somebody with Financial Weekly and wanted a quick word or two.
"Can I ask what you're doing here?" Derek said.
"Same thing you're doing here."
"And that is?"
"Enjoying the heat."
"Is it true that you have 25,000 Maxitil cases?"
"No."
"How many?"
26,000, Clay said.
"How much are they worth?"
"Somewhere between zero and a couple of billion."
Unknown to Clay, the judge had gagged the lawyers for both sides from then until the end of the trial. Since he was willing to talk, he attracted a crowd. He was surprised to see himself surrounded by reporters. He answered a few more questions without saying much at all. The next morning, the Arizona Ledger quoted him as claiming his cases could be worth $2 billion. It ran a photo of Clay outside the courtroom, microphones in his face, with the caption, "King of Torts in Town." The courtroom was packed with potential jurors and spectators. 9 a.m. came and went with no sign of the lawyers or the judge. They were in chambers, no doubt still arguing pretrial issues.
Bailiffs and clerks busied themselves around the bench. A young man in a suit emerged from the back, passed through the bar, and headed down the center aisle. He abruptly stopped, looked directly at Clay, then leaned down and whispered,
"Are you Mr. Carter?"
Taken aback, Clay nodded.
"The judge would like to see you."
The newspaper was in the middle of the judge's desk. Dale Mooneyham was in one corner of the large office. Roger Redding was leaning on a table by the window. The judge was rocking in his swivel chair. None of the three were happy. Very awkward introductions were made. Mooneyham refused to step forward and shake Clay's hand, preferring instead to offer a slight nod and a look that conveyed hatred.
"Are you aware of the gag order I've put in place, Mr. Carter?" asked the judge.
"No, sir."
"Well, there is one."
"I'm not one of the attorneys in this case," Clay said.
"We work hard at having fair trials in Arizona, Mr. Carter. Both sides want a jury as uninformed and as impartial as possible. Now, thanks to you, the potential jurors know that there are at least 26,000 similar cases out there."
"Maybe it was unavoidable," Clay said. He would never try a case in front of this judge. No sense being intimidated.
"Why don't you just leave the state of Arizona?" Mooneyham boomed from the corner.
"I really don't have to," Clay shot back.
"You want me to lose?" Mooneyham asked.
And with that, Clay had heard enough. He wasn't sure how his presence might harm Mooneyham's case, but why run the risk?
"Very well, Your Honor. I guess I'll be seeing you."
"An excellent idea," the judge said.
Oscar agreed to remain in Flagstaff and monitor the trial. Clay hopped on the Gulfstream for a very somber ride home. Banished from Arizona. In Reedsburg, the news that Hannah was laying off 1,200 workers brought the town to a halt. The announcement came in a letter written by Marcus Hannah and given to all employees. The company had bargained in good faith, but an overzealous and greedy law firm in D.C. had made unreasonable demands. In the cafes and barber shops, on the sidewalks around the town square, in the beer joints and pool halls, the town talked of nothing else. Every one of the 11,000 residents knew someone who just lost his or her job at Hannah. The layoffs were the biggest disaster in the quiet history of Reedsburg. Though the town was tucked away in the Alleghenies, word got out. News of the layoffs prompted a reporter for the Baltimore Herald to go to Reedsburg. He went to the cafes and pool halls and soccer games. The first of his two stories was as long as a short novel. An author bent on deliberate slander could not have been crueler. All of Reedsburg's misery could have easily been avoided if the class-action lawyer J. Clay Carter II of D.C. had not been strident in his quest for large fees. Clay read the story and wanted to sue the newspaper. Instead, he called his pilots and told them to hustle to the airport.
"Going where, sir?"
"I don't know. Where do you want to go?"
"Beg your pardon?"
"Biloxi, Mississippi."
"One person or two?"
"Just me." He hadn't seen Ridley in 24 hours and had no desire to take her with him. He needed time away from the city and anything that reminded him of it. But 2 days on French's yacht did little to help. Clay needed the company of another conspirator, but Patton was too preoccupied with other class actions. They ate and drank too much. French had two associates in the courtroom in Phoenix, and they were sending emails by the hour. Clay read the emails, and he talked to Mulrooney. Jury selection had taken one full day. Dale Mooneyham was now slowly laying out the plaintiff's case against the drug. The government study was powerful evidence. The jury was keenly interested in it.
"So far, so good," Oscar said. "Mooneyham is quite the actor, but Roger has better courtroom skills."
Late on the second afternoon, after a couple of vodkas on the deck, French asked Clay,
"How much cash you got left?"
"I don't know. I'm afraid to crunch the numbers."
"Take a guess."
"$20 million, maybe."
"And how much insurance?"
$10 million. They canceled me, but they're still on the line for Dyloft." French sucked on a lemon and said, "I'm not sure $30 million is enough for you."
"Doesn't appear to be sufficient, does it?"
"No. You have 21 claims now, and the number can only go up. We'll be lucky if we can settle these damn things for $3 mil each."
"How many do you have?"
19 as of yesterday."
"And how much cash do you have?"
$200 million.
"I'll be all right."
"And the other guys?" Clay asked.
Wes is fine. Carlos can survive if his number stays below 30. Didier's last two wives cleaned him out. He's dead. He'll be the first one to go bankrupt, which he's done before.
The first one? And who might be the second one? After a long silence, Clay asked, What happens if Goffman wins in Flagstaff?
Well, you're going to be one sick puppy, that's for damn sure. With time, your clients will revolt and you can tell them to get lost.
A big drink of vodka. But think positive. Mooneyham hasn't lost in ages. A big verdict and the whole world is different. You're sitting on a gold mine again. Clay left late the next morning and flew to Pittsburgh, anywhere but D.C. En route, he talked to Oscar, and he read the emails and news reports of the trial in Flagstaff. The plaintiff, a 66-year-old woman with breast cancer, had testified and presented her case beautifully. She was very sympathetic, and Mooneyham played her like a fiddle.
Go get 'em, old boy, Clay kept mumbling to himself.
He rented a car and drove northeast for 2 hours, into the heart of the Allegheny Mountains. Finding Reedsburg on the map was almost as difficult as finding it on a highway. As he crested a hill on the edge of town, he saw a mammoth plant in the distance.
Welcome to Reedsburg, Pennsylvania, a large sign said. Home of the Hanna Portland Cement Company.
He followed a sign to downtown and found a parking place on Main Street. Wearing jeans and a baseball cap with 3 days' worth of dark stubble, he was not worried about being recognized. He walked into Ethel's coffee shop and took a seat on a wobbly stool at the counter. Ethel herself greeted him and took his order, coffee and a grilled cheese sandwich. At a table behind him, two young men were talking about jobs. It was soon clear that neither was employed. One wore a denim cap with a Hanna Cement logo on the front. As Clay ate his grilled cheese, he listened as they fretted over unemployment benefits, mortgages, credit card bills, part-time work. One was planning to surrender his Ford pickup to the local dealer who had promised to resell it for him. Against the wall by the front door was a folding table with a large plastic water bottle on it. A handmade poster urged everyone to contribute to the Hanna Fund. A collection of coins and bills half-filled the bottle.
What's that for? Clay asked Ethel when she refilled his cup.
Oh, that? It's a drive to collect money for the families laid off out at the plant.
A few minutes later, Clay said goodbye to Ethel, paid his bill, and dropped a $100 bill into the water bottle. If Clay Carter had ever felt worse, he could not remember when. Ridley called Saturday evening, quite upset. She had been unable to locate Clay for 4 days. After listening to the whining for a few minutes, Clay heard something buzz in the line and asked, Where are you?
St. Bart's, in our villa.
How'd you get down there? Clay, of course, had been using the Gulf Stream.
I chartered a smaller jet. Too small, actually. We had to stop in San Juan for fuel. It wouldn't make it here nonstop.
Poor girl. Clay wasn't sure how she knew the number of the air charter service. Why are you down there? He asked, a stupid question.
I was so stressed out because I couldn't find you. You can't do that again, Clay.
He tried to link the two. His disappearance and her escape to St. Bart's, but quickly gave it up. I'm sorry, he said. I left town in a hurry. Pat and French needed me in Biloxi. I was too busy to call. A long pause as she debated whether she should forgive him right then or wait a day or two.
Promise me you won't do it again, she whimpered.
Clay wasn't in the mood for either whining or promising, and he found himself relieved that she was out of the country.
It won't happen again. Relax. Enjoy yourself down there.
Will you call me tomorrow? She asked.
Of course.
Jonah was back in town, with many adventures to report from the sailing life. They were to meet at 9 at a bistro on Wisconsin Avenue for a late and long dinner. Around 8:30, the phone rang, but the caller hung up without a word. Then it rang again, and Clay grabbed it as he was buttoning his shirt.
Is this Clay Carter? A male voice asked.
Yes, who's this?
I'm from Reedsburg, Pennsylvania, and I have some valuable information about the Hanna Company.
The words were chilling, and Clay sat on the edge of his bed. Keep him on the phone. He said as he tried to think clearly, Okay, I'm listening.
We can't talk over the phone, the voice said.
30 years old, white male, high school education.
Why not?
It's a long story. There are some papers.
Where are you? I'm in the city. I'll meet you in the lobby of the Four Seasons Hotel on M Street. We can talk there.
Not a bad plan. There would be plenty of foot traffic in the lobby, just in case someone wanted to pull out a gun and start shooting lawyers.
When? Clay asked.
Real soon. I'll be there in 5 minutes. How long will it take you?
Clay was not going to mention the fact that he lived 6 blocks away, though his address was no secret.
I'll be there in 10 minutes.
Good. I'm wearing jeans and a black Steelers cap.
I'll find you, Clay said, then hung up. He finished dressing and hustled out of his townhouse. Walking rapidly along Dumbarton, he tried to imagine what information he could need or even want on the Hanna Company. He'd just spent 18 hours in Reedsburg and was trying quite unsuccessfully to forget about the place. He turned south on 31st Street, mumbling to himself, lost in a world of conspiracies and payoffs and spy scenarios. A lady passed with a small dog in search of a suitable spot on the sidewalk to relieve itself. A young man in a black biker's jacket with a cigarette hanging from his mouth approached, though Clay barely saw him. As the two passed in front of a poorly lit townhouse and under the limbs of an old red maple, the man suddenly, with perfect timing and precision, unloaded a short right cross that caught Clay directly on the chin. Clay never saw it. He remembered a loud pop in his face and his head crashing into a wrought iron fence. There was a stick of some sort, and another man, two of them up there, throwing punches and flailing away. Clay rolled to his side and managed to get a knee under himself. Then the stick landed like a gunshot on the back of his skull. He heard a woman's voice in the distance. Then he passed out. Clay was taken to George Washington University Hospital, where a trauma team stabilized him. The initial exam revealed 2 large head wounds caused by something blunt, a cut on his right cheekbone, a cut in his left ear, and numerous contusions. The right fibula was cracked neatly in 2. The left kneecap was in pieces, and the left ankle was broken. His head was shaved, and 81 stitches were required to close the 2 large cuts. His skull was badly bruised but not fractured. 6 stitches in his cheekbone, 11 in his ear, and they rolled him into surgery to put his legs back together. Jonah began calling after waiting impatiently for 30 minutes. He left the restaurant after an hour and headed on foot to Clay's townhouse. He knocked on the door, rang the bell, cursed just under his breath, and was ready to throw rocks at the windows when he saw Clay's car parked between 2 others down the street. He thought it was Clay's car anyway. He walked slowly toward it. Something was wrong there. He just wasn't sure what. It was a black Porsche Carrera, all right, but it was covered with a white dust. He called the police. A torn and empty Hanna Portland cement bag was found under the Porsche. Someone had evidently covered the car with cement, then thrown water at it. In spots, especially on the roof and the hood, large patches of the cement had dried and stuck to the car. As the police inspected it, Jonah told them that its owner was unaccounted for. After a long computer search, Clay's name popped up, and Jonah took off for the hospital. He called Paulette, and she was there before he arrived. Clay was in surgery, but it was only broken bones and probably a concussion. His injuries did not appear life-threatening. Since Clay had no family in the city, Jonah and Paulette assumed the roles of spokesmen and decision-makers. At 1:30 a.m., a doctor reported to them that the surgery had gone smoothly. All the bones were set and ready to heal. Some pins and screws had been installed. Things couldn't be better. They would closely monitor brain activity. They were sure there was a concussion, but didn't know how serious it was. "He looks awful," she warned them. 2 hours went by as Clay was slowly moved upstairs. Jonah had insisted on a private room. They finally saw him just after 4 a.m. A mummy would have had less wrapping. They stood in muted silence, taking in the full extent of his wounds, listening to the monitor's click and beep, watching his chest move up and down very slowly. Then Jonah started laughing.
"Look at that son of a bitch," he said.
"Hush, Jonah," Paulette hissed, ready to slap him.
"There lies the king of torts," Jonah said, shaking with suppressed laughter. Then she too saw the humor. She managed to laugh without opening her mouth, and for a long moment they both stood at the foot of Clay's bed, working hard to contain their amusement. When the humor passed, she said, "You should be ashamed."
"I am," Jonah said. "I'm sorry." Clay finally came back from the dead around noon Sunday. Paulette was tossing on the foldaway when he said, "Who's there?"
She jumped up and ran to his side.
"It's me, Clay."
Through his swollen and blurry eyes, he could see a black face. It certainly wasn't Ridley. He reached out with a hand and said,
"Who?"
"Paulette, Clay. Can't you see?" "No. Paulette. What are you doing here?" His words were thick, slow, and painful. "Just taking care of you, boss."
"Where am I?"
"George Washington University Hospital."
"Why? What happened?"
"It's what they call an old-fashioned ass-kicking."
"What?"
"You got jumped. Two guys with sticks. You need some pain pills?"
The stories hit with a fury on Monday, and they were all the same. Paulette muted the television and Jonah hid the newspapers. Miss Glick and the rest of the firm circled the wagons and had no comment for everyone. She received an email from a sailboat captain claiming to be Clay's father. He was near the Yucatan Peninsula in the Gulf of Mexico, and could someone please update him on Clay's condition? She did so. Stable condition, broken bones, concussion. He thanked her and promised to check back the following day. Ridley arrived Monday afternoon. Paulette and Jonah cleared out, happy to leave the hospital for a while. Evidently, Georgians did not understand proper hospital waiting rituals. Whereas Americans move in with their beloved sick and wounded, those from other cultures deem it more practical to stop by for an hour, then let the hospital take care of its patients. A detective stopped by with some questions. All suspicion pointed to some thugs from Reedsburg, but there was scant proof. Clay was unable to describe the man who threw the first punch.
"I never saw it," he said, rubbing his chin.
Flowers poured in. Adelpha Pumphrey, Glendead OPD, Mr. and Mrs. Rex Criddle, Rodney, Patton French, Wes Salisbury, a judge Clay knew from Superior Court. Jonah brought a laptop, and Clay had a lengthy chat with his father. Early Tuesday morning, Zach Battle stopped by on his way to the office and delivered some welcome news. The SEC was suspending its investigation of Clay. He had talked to Mel Snelling's lawyer in Baltimore. Mel wasn't budging, wasn't caving into FBI pressure, and without Mel, they could not put together the necessary evidence. Meanwhile, the boredom of the hospital was hitting hard. The traction, the bedpans, the relentless visits by the nurses at all hours, the sheer tedium of lying there unable to move. The aftershocks of the actual beating came to haunt him, and he remembered more of the sounds and physical sensations of being pummeled. Ridley was good for an hour late in the morning and another late in the afternoon. She stood by his bed and was very affectionate, especially when the nurses were around. Paulette detested her and was quick to disappear when she entered the room. "She's after your money," she said to Clay.
"And I'm after her body," Clay said.
"Well, right now she's getting the better end of the deal." He was doing his best to browse through the newspaper articles from Arizona when Paulette answered the phone. "It's Oscar," she said. They had talked briefly on Sunday night, but Clay had been drugged and incoherent. Now he was wide awake and ready for details. "Let's hear it," he said. "Mooneyham arrested Saturday morning. His case could not have been more perfect. The guy is brilliant, and he has the jury eating out of his hands. Roger Redding put on their star expert yesterday afternoon, a researcher who testified that there is no direct link between the drug and the plaintiff's breast cancer. I thought the guy was very good, very believable. Hell, he has three doctorates. The jury paid attention. Then Mooneyham ripped him to shreds. He pulled out some bad research the guy did 20 years ago. I've never seen a witness so thoroughly humiliated."
"Beautiful, beautiful," Clay kept saying. The phone stuck to the gauze on the left side of his face, opposite the slashed ear.
"Here's the good part. I found out where the Goffman folks are staying, so I switched hotels. I see them at breakfast. I see them in the bar late at night. I hear they're kicking around the possibilities of a settlement."
"Say it again," Clay said softly.
"You heard me. Goffman, at this very moment, is thinking about settling with Mooneyham. They are terrified. They're convinced, like everybody else in the courtroom, that this jury is about to nuke their company."
And with that, the pain immediately vanished.
The throbbing skull was still. The heavy casts were feather-like. The delicate bruises ceased to exist. Clay felt like crying.
"Keep me posted," he told Oscar.
"Don't worry, Chief. How are the broken bones?"
"Much better now." Paulette took the phone. Seconds later, it rang again. She answered, handed it back to Clay, and said, "It's for you, and I'm getting out of here." It was Rebecca, in the hospital's lobby, on her cell phone, wondering if a quick visit would be appropriate. Minutes later, she walked into his room and was shocked at the sight of him. She kissed him on the cheek between bruises. "They had sticks," Clay said, "to even things out. Otherwise, I would have had an unfair advantage." He punched the controls to the bed and began raising himself into the V.
"You look awful," she said. Her eyes were moist.
"Thank you. You, on the other hand, look spectacular." She kissed him again, same place, and began rubbing his left arm. A moment of silence passed between them.
"Can I ask you a question?" Clay said.
"Sure. Where is your husband right now?"
"He's in either Sao Paulo or Hong Kong. I can't keep track."
"Does he know you're here?"
"Of course not." She paused. "It's not working, Clay. I want out." In spite of his wounds, Clay was having an awesome day. A fortune was within his grasp, as was Rebecca. The door to his room opened quietly, and Ridley entered. She was at the foot of his bed, unnoticed, when she said,
"Sorry to interrupt."
"Hi, Ridley," Clay said weakly. The women gave each other looks that would terrify cobras. Ridley moved to the other side of the bed, directly opposite Rebecca, who kept her hand on Clay's bruised arm.
"Ridley, this is Rebecca. Rebecca, this is Ridley."
Neither smiled. Ridley reached over just a few inches and began gently rubbing Clay's right arm. Though he was being pampered by two beautiful women, he felt more like fresh roadkill seconds before the wolves arrived.
"I believe we were at your wedding reception," Ridley said finally, a not-too-subtle reminder to Rebecca that she happened to be married.
"Uninvited, as I recall," Rebecca said.
"Oh, darn. Time for my enema," Clay said. And nobody laughed but him. If a catfight broke out across his bed, he'd be mauled even worse.
Where were the nurses?
Rebecca blinked first. She had no choice. She did, after all, have a husband.
"I guess I'll be going."
She left the room slowly, as if she didn't want to leave, didn't want to concede territory. Clay was thrilled by that.
As soon as the door closed, Ridley withdrew to the window, where she stood for a long time and looked at nothing. Clay scanned a newspaper, completely unconcerned with her and whatever her moods might be. The cold shoulder she was working diligently to deliver happened to be welcome.
"You love her, don't you?" Ridley said, still looking out the window, trying to appear wounded.
"No, she's just an old friend."
With that, she wheeled around and walked to the side of his bed.
"I'm not stupid, Clay."
"Didn't say you were." He was still reading the newspaper, quite unmoved by this attempt at high drama. She grabbed her purse and stomped out of his room, heels clicking as loudly as possible. A nurse entered shortly thereafter to inspect him for damages.
Oscar called a few minutes later on his cell phone outside the courtroom. A quick recess had been ordered.
"Rumor has it Mooneyham turned down $10 million this morning," he said.
"Who's on the